Daniel chapter 4, pages 750 to 752 in the blue books. The Bible's underneath the chair in front of you, somewhere around you. You might want to keep your finger in there because we're going to be looking at different passages throughout the message. He was murderous, arrogant, materialistic, idolatrous, an enemy of God's people, and a terrible dancer. Just checking to see if you're paying attention here. He defeated, captured, and removed God's people from their homeland. He was not above selectively and capriciously removing the heads of his subjects. He issued death decrees like they were party invitations, simply because he had had a bad dream and he was a tiny bit cranky. He created an idolatrous golden statue and demanded total compliance, no exception, worship of it. For those who objected, he ordered live cremation. Clearly, he was already a monster. He was already a beast. He just didn't realize it yet. He didn't see it yet. Please turn with me, like I said, to Daniel. As you're turning there, or as you've gotten there, hopefully by now, let me give you a bit of background. This is a unique passage of Scripture because it is the testimony of a pagan king to the glory and supremacy, and most importantly, the sovereignty of Yahweh. This pagan king, this murderous, arrogant, materialistic, idolatrous enemy of God's people, writes an open letter of praise to Yahweh for everyone in his kingdom to read. And in so doing, he acknowledges that even he is under the rule of Yahweh. In fact, all kings and all kingdoms are under the rule of Yahweh because he is most high. It's a pretty good observation for a grumpy heads will roll through another body on the barbecue kind of king, isn't it? Now, clearly, something amazing has happened. In fact, it's so amazing that Nibby gets a whole chapter in Daniel's book. A chapter that he writes the majority of. That's an extraordinary thing when you think about it. Okay, but what exactly happened? Well, thankfully, we're told in the first few verses because Nibby begins with the conclusion. You know, just like a lot of movies and shows do today, things start off with bombs going off and heroes looking like they're about to die, and then it says at the bottom of the screen, 72 hours before. And you're back in time and you start to see the events that unfold, and then finally you end up back where you began, with a big happy ending. Nibby does exactly that. Nibby begins at the end and then moves back in time to share the experience that brought him to this conclusion. And then the chapter ends where it begins, in praise. This is a literary trick that's probably overused today, but it was quite good back then. I understand why Nibby uses it. He doesn't want to bury the lead. He doesn't want to wait until the end before he praises. He starts with praise. He must start with praise. It's the only appropriate way to begin this story. You know, I believe that Nibby becomes a believer in Yahweh. And whether he gives up the other gods is another question. But one thing I do know, he is changed. He's humbled. And he declares of himself, my reason has returned to me. I see reality now. Beginning with verse 1. King Nebuchadnezzar, to the nations and peoples of every language who live in all the earth, may you prosper greatly. It is my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an eternal kingdom. His dominion endures from generation to generation. Let's stop there. Notice the phrase nations and peoples in every language who live on earth. Last time we heard something like that was back in chapter 3. And it went something like this. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, nations and peoples of every language, this is what you're commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. It's a radical change between chapter 3 and chapter 4. But remember, the beginning of chapter 4 is the conclusion of what happens. So the radical change in the king's perspective is a subplot of what is happening in chapter 4. It's not the main point, but it's an important point nonetheless. Nebi goes from blowing his own horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and etc. Instead, sends out a royal account to his entire empire about the amazing encounter he had with Yahweh and how he is a zero and Yahweh is a hero. Continuing with verse 4. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. I had a dream that made me afraid. As I was lying in bed, the images and visions that passed through my mind terrified me. What is it with this guy in dreams? Notice how he describes himself, though. I was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. Nebi's chillaxing. Are the cool kids still using that word? I don't know. Actually, I did know. It's okay, I'm going to bring it back. I'm going to make it happen again. We don't know how much time went between chapter 2 and 3, but it's considerable. Perhaps as much as 16 years in one estimate. Chapter 4 will be the last we hear of Nebi. He has established his rule. He is at a point in his life where he's enjoying a time of peace. The hard work is done. He's satisfied with where he is and where his kingdom is. But in the middle of patting himself on the back for a job well done, he has another dream. It seems that his accomplishments in position and money aren't enough to keep the bad dreams from coming his way. You know, we desire self-sufficiency and control in life. We're taught to take charge of our own lives, to make our own breaks. We're told to study longer and work harder and plan better than the next guy because that's how you succeed. We're told that those who strive for excellence hold their destinies in their own hands. Hurrah, you know. And we believe it. But even in those moments of self-satisfaction and contentment, there's this tiny mental worm that wiggles its way into our brains and whispers a truth that we really need to hear. And unfortunately, we often ignore it. Here's what the worm whispers. We can never know enough, do enough, or have enough to have ultimate control over our lives. We can never know enough, do enough, or have enough, or be enough to have ultimate control over our lives. Now, sometimes this truth can't be ignored. Sometimes our insanity becomes reason and reality when we lose our job, or our savings takes a dive, or our health goes south, or our family or relationships explode. But sometimes, particularly when we're in our prideful contentment and enjoying the kingdom we've built, God taps us on the shoulder and he reminds us of just how deluded we really are. This is what God's doing in this dream that he sent Nebi. Now, unlike the first dream in Daniel 2, Nebuchadnezzar goes ahead and explains the dream to the astrologers and various assorted wise men. But we're told that, again, that they couldn't tell him the meaning of the dream. Once again, human wisdom falls short. But still, I kind of wonder about this because the dream really isn't that hard to figure out. I mean, have you read it? It's kind of obvious, really. Yeah, I think any of us could get the gist of the dream without too much difficulty. In fact, I think Nebi's pretty much has the whole dream figured out for himself. He just doesn't want it to be true. And given Nebi's temper, I think the wise men have it figured out as well. They just don't want to be in a position of giving the king bad news and thereby having their heads moved to a new postal code. The king remembers that Daniel saved the day with the last dream. So he sends for him. And again, you kind of wonder, why didn't he just send for Daniel in the first place? Perhaps it was because he didn't want the dream that terrified him to really be a dream that should terrify him. We all play these mental games of denial sometimes. In verse 8, Daniel's introduced again by his Babylonian name, Belteshazzar, which is, the king tells us, a name connected to his God. And then he goes on to say that Daniel had the spirit of the holy gods in him. So this is where the king is at this point in time in the story. This is before the miraculous signs and wonders take place. And clearly, he doesn't quite know Daniel or Daniel's God. He knows Daniel has power and insight and wisdom, and he's a godly man, but that's about it. Then the king tells Daniel his dream. In his dream is a tree in the middle of the land, and this tree is enormous, ginormous. Its branches reach high up into the sky, and it gives shade and habitat and abundant food and protection for everyone. The image of the trees, as well as mountains, and indeed the Tower of Babel, all communicate the very same idea. And it's the idea that heaven and earth can be joined together somehow. Remember back in Daniel 2, the wise men commented, "The gods do not live among men." And that was the current understanding of the day, at least for those who weren't Jews. And so, in these images, we have the reflection of the idea of trying to achieve the divine status. The dream is pointing to the king's heart. He sees himself as the divine protector and sustainer of all who inhabit his kingdom. He is the king of the greatest empire of his day. Daniel bears this out in the interpretation when he indicates that the king is indeed the tree in the stream. Picking things up in verse 13. "In the visions I saw while lying in bed, I looked, and there before me was a holy one, a messenger, coming down from heaven. He called in a loud voice, 'Cut down the tree and trim off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its roots bound with iron and bronze remain in the ground, in the grass of the field.'" And then notice the shift in verse 15. "Let him," not the tree, but "let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. And let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man. And let him be given the mind of an animal till seven times pass by for him." Verse 13, we have a holy one, a messenger. The word is actually watcher. You know, we're dealing with a spiritual being here, an angel with a message for the king. And it begins with an order to cut down the tree. This is where things start to get terrifying. But the tree isn't completely destroyed. In fact, the command is given to bind it with iron and bronze, and this detail pretty much leaves everyone scratching their heads as to what exactly it means, but it is probably something to do with the fact that the stump is being protected from being completely destroyed. So there's this hope that's here. What is being described is devastating, but it isn't final or fatal. It will happen until seven times pass by for him. What are seven times? Some people simply say 7 years. But this is symbolic language. So it might be 7 years, or it might be seven seasons, or it might simply be the use of seven as the perfect or complete time. In other words, until the king has experienced what it takes to teach him what he needs to learn and turn around, that's how long it's going to be. Now, what is it that needs to happen here? What is it that makes him turn around? What is it that he has to learn? Verse 17. The decision is announced by the messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict, so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of people. This is the message of Daniel 4. Whatever else we may learn from Daniel 4, it's secondary to what this one lesson teaches us. This is the point. This message isn't, though, just for the king. It is for the king, but it isn't just for the king. It's so that the living may know. So check your pulse. It's for us. So that the living might know. It's for everyone who's breathing. And it's for them to know and to respond accordingly. Yahweh, the Most High God, is sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth. How do we know that? Because he gives them to anyone he wishes, and he sets over them the lowliest of people. So the implications here are threefold. First of all, Yahweh is the Most High. He's sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth. We may think that God isn't really involved in our world. We worry about those who are in power and those who are seeking power. And we see the strife and the hardships such powers bring in our world. But remember the context. This is a message to the Jews in exile. It's a message to those who had lost friends and families, homes and futures. It's a message to those who were yanked from their homeland. Their lives had been impacted by Nebuchadnezzar in ways we can't even begin to understand. King Nebi was the symbol of power that they were powerless to resist. And yet, if the events of this dream come true, and we know they do, the reality is that King Nebi is completely powerless against Yahweh. Yahweh strips him of everything. So what's the significance in that? Well, first of all, that means that they're in Babylon because it was God's will, not because of the king's will. That's kind of a big thing to try to deal with there. Not that they didn't know that. Secondly, they as a people are not helpless or forgotten or under the control of a pagan king, because the pagan king is under the control of their God. So whatever they're going through, and however lost, broken, and dark their future may seem, the reality is God is there, and he's not forsaken them, and he's not left them victims to the culture or victims to the chaos. Going back to what we learned from verse 17. First, Yahweh, the Most High, is sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth. Second, the great King Nebuchadnezzar isn't a king because of his intelligence or his good looks. We already talked about his dancing, so we'll leave that out. His military prowess, or because he was better or smarter or more driven than anyone else, or even that he was in the right place at the right time. Despite all his pride in his accomplishments, the truth was that he was king because Yahweh allowed him to be king. It's kind of part of the equation that he never thought about. And sometimes we don't either. You know, think about it. Our intellect, our abilities, our accomplishments may be a factor in success. Not denying that. But they don't ultimately determine our futures or provide our security. In other words, talents, brains, and opportunity mean nothing apart from God's activity. How easy is it to take pride in our accomplishments? How easy is it to think that everything we have is what we've earned? How easy is it for us to hold on to what we have with clenched fists because we've worked hard for everything we have? And we can take pride in the fact that we work hard, and that's fine. We can have a sense of satisfaction in our accomplishments. That's natural. But not at the expense of thinking that we did it all on our own. You know, as soon as we think we did it all on our own, self-worship starts. Pride grows and generosity towards God and His people fade. It fades because we start to think, why should I give anything back to God when I believe He had no part in what I earned in the first place? The things I worked so hard for, I earned them. I deserve them. And that's why our giving is a true reflection of our hearts before God. And it's an act of worship. Think about it. Sometimes we even take pride in what we do for God. In a bad sense, in a negative sense. And we may say to others, give God the glory. Oh, it's not me, it's God. But we can be thinking at the same time, yeah, I know I'm good. God must be pleased to have me on His team. Dr. Larry Crabb, in his wonderful book, Finding God, makes this brutally honest admission about the time he spoke at his brother's memorial service after his brother had died in a plane crash. He said, "Within days of my brother's death, I spoke at his memorial service. As I prepared for my few comments on behalf of our family, I prayed that God would use my stumbling tongue in this difficult situation to encourage others to trust in the goodness of God, no matter what might happen in their lives. I wanted to give. At one point during my talk, I noticed that a phrase I had just used was especially rich. And as any experienced public speaker might do, I paused. I heard these words run through my mind. I'm doing a pretty good job. That was a good pause. Immediately, I felt slapped in the face by the realization that at the moment I cared more about how I was performing than how meaningfully I was ministering. That night, I wept bitterly. I grieved that even at my brother's funeral, I couldn't escape the wretched power of pride. I had come to an audience filled with friends wanting to share our grief, and I wanted them to applaud my speaking ability. Without words, I had said to them, I need you. Please stroke my ego and help me feel good about the talents God has given me. What I find interesting about this comment from Dr. Crabb is that it shows me that he's a mature Christian who's sensitive enough that the Spirit of God can immediately slap him in the head over stepping over the prideful line. You know, Crabb's admission that he shows his spiritual victory, not his spiritual defeat, because he caught himself in the sin. Many Christians in the same situation with the same thoughts wouldn't even notice a switch in focus from God and ministry to self. We always need to remember the message of Psalm 127. Unless the Lord builds the house, the builder labors in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. Nothing we do, nothing we accomplish has any real foundation unless we acknowledge and pray and seek God as the builder of all that we do. The third lesson from verse 17 is that Yahweh uses humble people. He sets over them the lowliest of people. In God's economy, the first will be last, and the greatest will be least of these. In Israel's history, God set his kingdom in over his kingdom, the young David, bypassing his older brothers. He chose the younger Solomon over Adonijah. Israel prophesied about God's chosen servant that he was despised and rejected by men. But God gave him a portion among the great. Jesus was born in a stable, poor, despised, and eventually crucified. But he claimed after his resurrection that God had given him all authority in heaven and on earth. God can use anyone, but he prefers to use the lowliest of people. Why? Because the success of the lowliest of people more clearly shows his handiwork. And those who depend on his strength always have more power than those who are strong in themselves. As Jesus told Paul, "My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness." What we must remember about Daniel 4 is that all that God is doing in Nebuchadnezzar's life is removing his pride and humbling him. So when Nebi raises his eyes to heaven and praises Yahweh, we are told, at the same time, my reason was restored. My honor and splendor will return to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne, and I became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Let me just point out a few other things before we close. After the king tells Daniel his dream, we're told, then Daniel, also called Belshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time. And his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, Belshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you. And then Daniel answers, my lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. I think Daniel's actually upset here. I don't think he's afraid of the message. But he's upset. He's upset at the prospect that the king is having to go through such an ordeal of losing his sanity and being driven into solitude and becoming an animal, exposed to the elements, living without anything or anyone to give him comfort. Daniel's known this king for years. And even monsters have their good sides. What a testimony to Daniel. He has compassion for his captor. And this isn't Stockholm syndrome. He knew that he is in exile because God is punishing his rebellious people. He knows ultimately that God has brought this pain into his life and the life of his people in order to save them. But he also knows that it's not easy, even though it's necessary and it's loving. Daniel knows that God is going to do a similar work in the king, and instead of gloating, he has sympathy. He knows that because of our stubborn, prideful, rebellious, idolatrous hearts, God must do something drastic sometimes to get our attention and bring us back to him. So Daniel has not been hardened by his experience. He hasn't allowed his experience to make him bitter towards God or even towards the king. Why? Because he knows that God was sovereign over all peoples. And God has a plan, and God is doing a work, a necessary work. After Daniel describes what the dream is, he indicates again what will happen to the king. He pleads with the king. Verse 27. Therefore, your majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right, and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed, that it may be that then your prosperity will continue. Daniel's love for the king compels him to tell the king the truth. Now, you might not be aware of this, but telling kings to renounce their sins and wickedness wasn't something that was normally done. It was suicidal. Just talking to the king out of turn was suicidal. But for Daniel, I believe he figured that he was brought before the king for a purpose, and he was going to be obedient to God's purpose, regardless of the consequences. Ultimately, Daniel was being loving here. He told the truth to the king in the hopes that the king would listen and avoid God's judgment. He thought of the king's interests more than his own. Now, sometimes I've missed the opportunities to tell the truth to people, to tell the truth about the dangers of what they were in, because I didn't want to deal with conflict. I didn't want to look like that guy. I didn't want the anger. I didn't want the awkwardness. And that's being self-centered, not being loving. I also want you to notice that this dream sent to the king by the King of Heaven was a warning, not a judgment. It only became a judgment. A judgment that had a purpose of restoration. Daniel's words points this out. The implication seems to be that if the king repented, God wouldn't have to carry out the details of the dream. So the dream's a warning. That's what it's functioning as. So Daniel 4 isn't about Yahweh punishing an evil king. It's about Yahweh graciously reaching out in love, because he cares even for King Nebi. If the king could stop acting like he was a wild beast and start acting like an image bearer, Yahweh wouldn't have to allow the beast to completely take over. Sometimes we blame God or others for the things that we're going through. We're just the victims. But they could have been avoided if only we were open and listening to God. It's a sobering thought, isn't it? What could we have avoided if we'd only listened? Is your heart open now? Are you listening now? And what's God telling you now? Let me point something out to you. This is important for us to understand. This is one account of one king who is part of God's plan. The king could have continued in his pride. He could have remained the animal that he'd already proven himself to be. But God knew that Nebi would eventually look up, and he would then have his reason restored. Even so, the truth is that sometimes bad things happen to good people. And sometimes bad people get away with being bad. So Daniel 4 is not a textbook example of how life always works, is what I'm saying. The psalmist observes this when he wrote, I love this psalm. Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. It's a good start. But as for me, my feet almost slipped. I nearly lost my foothold. I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They're free from common human burdens. They're not plagued by human ills. Therefore, pride is their necklace. They clothe themselves with violence. From their callous hearts comes iniquity. Their evil imaginations have no limits. They scoff and they speak with malice. He's kind of got a thing on for these guys, don't you think? This is how he sees it. They scoff and they speak with malice. With arrogance, they threaten oppression. Their mouths lay claim to heaven and their tongues take possession of the earth. They're all and all and all of it. Therefore, let people turn to them and drink up waters in abundance. They say, how would God know? Does the Most High know anything? This is what the wicked are like, always free of care. They go on amassing wealth. Surely, in vain I have kept my heart pure and have washed my hands in innocence. All day long I've been afflicted, and every morning brings new punishments. If I had spoken out like that, I would have betrayed your children. He was in such a bad place that he didn't want to say anything about how he was feeling because he didn't want to ruin anybody else's faith. When I tried to understand all this, it troubled me deeply till I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. Did you catch what he's saying here? He's saying when he looked at the seeming prosperity of the arrogant and the wicked, it became a source of bitterness to him. Their mouths lay claim to heaven. Their tongues take possession of the earth. They think they're untouchable. They think they're everything. They're masters of their own fate, in control of their destinies. They mock God and they still continue to amass wealth. So the psalmist says, why bother? What's the point? What's the point of following Yahweh? What good does it really do? I'm over here suffering. Every morning's a new problem and pain. And his envy and his bitterness towards his own experience and towards the God who allowed it put him in spiritual danger. That is, until he entered the sanctuary of God. And then he understood their final destiny. You know, from our perspective, bad people seem to get away with murder and have a wonderful time doing it. And God's people often suffer for doing the right thing. What's the solution? How do we get past that? It's by entering the sanctuary and realizing that God has given us the greatest gift, a relationship with him that's eternal and far better than anything that this life can provide. But there's more. This comes to him in the sanctuary. It doesn't come to him after his Fruit Loops in the morning. It comes to him in the sanctuary, in worship. When he's focused on God. So it isn't just that he knew he would get a better deal from God in the end. He understood that knowing God right now is far better. Far better than the scoffer who has and does everything, but doesn't know Yahweh. So don't miss the message here. No one is good enough to be without sin, and no one is bad enough to go beyond the grace of God. The grace of God that he offers to everyone, even King Nebi. All I have to do is look at Nebi and learn from him, who said, when the period was over, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven and my reason returned to me. I blessed the Most High and I praised and honored the one who lives forever. For his sovereignty is an everlasting sovereignty and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. We need to wrap things up, but what do I want you to take home with you? What's important here? First of all, we're not enough. You can never know enough, do enough, be enough, or have enough to have ultimate control over your lives. In parts of the world, you can kind of fool yourself into thinking about that for a while. But it's only temporary. In most parts of the world, you can't. To think we can, to try and go along as our own God, is nothing short of insanity. It's delusional to think we can build our own kingdoms and pretend we're safe. Because life's not safe. This world's not safe. We're not safe. Secondly, God is sovereign. He's in control. Not in the sense that we're robots or that we don't have choices to make or responsibilities before Him. What this does mean is that the real mover and shaker of this world is the King of Heaven. Heaven is the realm of Yahweh that coexists with earth right now. Right here. And it is the King of Heaven that's in control of all the kingdoms of the earth. What does this mean and how does this play out? That's a topic of discussion that would take us into next week. But what isn't up for discussion is that God's will, His plan of salvation, His restoration of heaven and earth will be carried out. And no king, no government, no other spiritual power has anything to say about it. So don't worry about the government. Sure, the world's hostile. And there can be real problems and real suffering as a result. But that's not final. And God can use it for good. Think about this. Nebuchadnezzar calls his suffering, his insanity, his own personal exile in his own personal nakedness, this being stripped of everything. He calls it a sign and a wonder. Miraculous. The worst thing that ever happened to him was the best thing that ever happened to him. The worst thing that ever happened to him didn't point him to a world without God. It pointed him to the God of this world. So step into the sanctuary. And realize what you have in Christ, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Finally, be reasonable. When Nebi looks up and he saw Yahweh for who he really was, the Lord Most High, reason returned to him. Like I've already said, to live our lives on as our own gods, thinking we can do everything on our own is insanity. To worship ourselves or our own accomplishments, our own abilities, our own intelligence is insanity. It takes us from being image bearers to wild beasts, disconnected from each other and the things that make us truly human. It takes our potential and it turns it into rebellion instead of acts of praise. What's the reasonable thing? Paul tells us in Romans 12. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Paul says, in view of all that God has given to you, all that God has done through the sacrifice and resurrection of Christ, through the mercy and the grace offered freely at great cost, as Peter so wonderfully shared with us around the table. When you look at all of that, what's the appropriate response? To offer your body up as a living sacrifice. He calls it the true and proper worship. And the Greek here can be translated as, this is your rational act of worship. This is what you do when you come to your senses. This is what you do when you're no longer deluded. This is what you do when reason has returned. When you understand you are not God. When your tree no longer touches the heavens. When you see yourself as you are and Jesus as He really is and realize the delusion that you've been under, that we've been under. The love that God really has expressed through Christ. The rescue made possible through that sacrifice. The only rational thing to do is to give your entire life over to Him. And how do you do that? How do you do that in a hostile world? He tells us. The next verse. Do not conform to the pattern of this world. But be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good and pleasing and perfect will. Don't conform to the pattern of this world. Step into the sanctuary. Don't buy into the culture. Renew your mind. Allow God to show you His reality. See who God really is and what He's done for you, and then give yourself to living out His good, pleasing, and perfect will.